You've worked hard to build your brand, so why settle for one-size-all-fits branded clothing? Lands' End Outfitters creates apparel your employees will truly want to wear, all backed by above-and-beyond expertise. See why Lands' End Outfitters has been a branded apparel supplier to some of the world's most respected brands for more than 30 years. Go to business.landsend.com/pod20 and use code pod20 for 20% off your first product. That's business.landsend.com/pod20, code pod20, for 20% off your first product.
On the record, on News Talk,
brought to you by PwC. Great minds think unalike. It all adds up to the new equation.
Going through this morning's newspapers with Hugh O'Connell, political correspondent for the Sunday and Irish Independent, and also by Janet Horner, a Green Party member of Dublin City Council. Thank you both for coming in this morning. Hugh, I'll start with yourself because your title this morning, the Sunday Independent, leading with an extensive sit-down interview conducted with the Taoiseach Micheál Martin, in which he says, no going back to lockdown, or which at least he says, we're not contemplating introducing any extra restrictions, which sounds like the formulation of language that he's used before when he's not contemplating doing things that he's ended up possibly having to do.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I think ultimately we can't ever rule out going back to restrictions given, you know, the way that the virus works, I guess. But certainly it's not being talked about by people in NPHET. It's not being taught at the moment, as far as we know. And it's not being talked about by people in government. There's no sense I get from talking to people over the last few days that there's any plan to reimpose restrictions. It's really a case of, well, what do we do with the remaining restrictions that were all due to lift on Friday? And the mood is very much that, you know, we could probably lift some of them, but do it in a way that you control it to, and you can find certain activities that we would open up from Friday onwards, or perhaps a couple of weeks down the line, to people who have vaccination certificates. And you can see in other papers today, there's a suggestion that there'll be a big push now to get the 370,000 people who are either not vaccinated at all or have only had one dose to take that second dose, or to else avail of the first dose and then get the second dose.
Do you think that'll work though? Because there's not much carrot and there's an awful lot of stick there, but it doesn't seem to change the dynamic beyond what there's already been. If those people haven't been allowed to eat indoors for the last couple of months anyway, why would they change now?
It's a fair point. I don't know if they would necessarily, but even if you see in our paper today, there's some figures from the HSE which would suggest that in the kind of last 3 days of last week, there was a slight uptick in the level of registration for vaccination, 3,500, I think close to 3,500 people registering over a three-day period, compared to just to 2,500 walking into vaccine centres last weekend, walking vaccination centres last weekend. So it suggests that the focus on the 370,000 people who haven't had a vaccine, and a lot of people talking about that publicly this week, has inspired some, for want of a better phrase, to register for their vaccine. But look, it's inevitable that there will be a sizable cohort in this country made up of tens of thousands of people who just will never get the vaccine.
Janet Horner, how do you feel about that? Do you think that people would actually take up the invitation to accept a vaccine if it meant that it was the only way to eat indoors at coming up to Christmas time, for example?
I think it's important that people are given push to do it. I think they need to be. I think more than that, for me, I think it's about keeping people safe who have chosen to take the vaccine, so that there's the vast majority of people in the country have taken the vaccine now. And I think they deserve to be given a safe environment to operate in. So they deserve to be in restaurants, in bars, where they know that they are surrounded by other people who have taken a vaccine and they are not been compromised in a way that might mean they don't have the option to.
But if those who have received the vaccine are still likely, perhaps not as likely, but are still likely to pass on the virus to others, then does it really give them all that much safeguarding if you're going to be in a crowded restaurant with plenty of other people who are, yes, vaccinated and who might not get too ill themselves but could still pass on the virus to you?
And I think that's the calculated risk that we are all making at the moment. We're all having to figure that out as we're sort of making the choice about where we go and who we meet and in what settings. But I think that is a reasonable level of safety that we can provide, the state can provide to people, to allow them to make informed decisions about where they go. I personally think that when there is a high risk, when we're seeing the numbers so high at the moment, it's not necessarily fair on other people to increase that risk for them, and to compromise their safety when they go into further compromise their safety when they do things which I think after 18 months of this, 19 months of it now, we all deserve to be able to eat in a restaurant with a small number of our friends and family leading up to Christmas. And I think we deserve to do that safely.
So do you make it then that, as it currently stands, pending the government receiving any advice from NPHET or NIAC, that they're likely to allow nightclubs to reopen from next weekend, but only for those who are vaccinated? Well, it seems like you're not maybe going to gain a huge amount if, okay, granted, if a condition of getting in is that you're vaccinated, but if there's no social distancing, as nightclubs don't tend to observe, it kind of seems counterproductive.
Well, it does, yeah. So that's, I suppose, one of the questions that will be asked at the NPHET meeting tomorrow, and then, you know, government will have to consider what NPHET advises around that. But I think the concern at the moment is, and I think one of your previous interview alluded to this, is that the lack of social distancing in certain settings is having an impact. You know, whether you're vaccinated or not, you still are more susceptible to picking it up. So I think that NPHET people are kind of concerned about really crowded indoor settings with a lack of ventilation. That's the big problem for them. So I think that in that context, you might see a situation where the reopening of nightclubs is definitely confined to vaccinated people, but also maybe that they hold off a couple of weeks on that. But I don't know. I mean, I think it's a hard judgment call to make, ultimately, because at some stage we're going to have to, you know, open these places up.
Well,
you know,
unless
we decide that we're just not going to have clubbing anymore, which I don't think is something.
Well, no, it's certainly Margaret Harris seems like she
could contemplate with people of an older age as well. Not
Margaret
myself.
Harris certainly sounded like she was possibly up for that idea, but I don't think the rest of us would sort of tolerate that too kindly, even if we're not necessarily clubbers ourselves. The HSE's figures last night: there were 305 people in intensive care for any reason. 305 adults in intensive care, of whom 71 were there with COVID-19, and then there were 11 vacant beds. But I think, Hugh, if that means that there's space for 316, that means that they've already kind of gone into surge capacity, which means that they're probably already cancelling some elective surgeries. And it does beg the question, and I don't mean for this to be a slur on the nightclub industry or anyone who's still waiting to go back to work, but whether them going back to work and reopening nightclubs, even for the vaccinated only, is a worthwhile price to pay if it means cancelling more surgeries.
I mean,
for people
I think
put
you're
off.
Probably going to see a little bit of a surge in hospitalizations anyway, because case numbers have gone up over the last few weeks, so that automatically will translate into a rise in hospitalizations. But the key thing is that vaccination has meant that fewer people are going to hospital now when they contract the virus than was the case pre-vaccination. So, you know, it's a hard call. It's a hard judgment call. NPHET will give advice. They'll probably give, I mean, you know, judging by their last letter, there was somewhat ambiguous advice around when to lift all restrictions. I mean, they were talking about the health service not being under strain, a 90% vaccination rate, okay, which is a measurable target. But there was other things as well that were less clearly indicated. It was kind of deliberately ambiguous, I suppose, to give government the space to make the decisions that they made. And the decision they made was to set October the 22nd. That date's coming up now. Case numbers are rising. So in that context, there probably does have to be a reconsideration of the original plan.
In hindsight, knowing as they did that they did project there to be a peak in cases around now, you sort of wonder how exactly they arrived at October the 22nd as being the date to allow everything go. But maybe that's a question for another day, or at least if we had an epidemiologist in the room. Janet, I know that you're quite interested in the whole area of the nighttime economy and trying to get hospitality and nighttime going back again, but you have to imagine that all of that is genuinely cast in doubt if the government is now contemplating whether it's possible to reopen nightclubs or late bars on a proper sustainable basis with only partial capacity, or only when some people aren't allowed inside the door.
Yeah, I mean, and I think we have to look at what our nighttime economy looks like. Our nighttime economy has relied enormously on pubs, drinking culture overall. And I think part of what faces us the challenge for it now is whether we're going to be able to revision that, whether we're going to be able to look at more outdoor nighttime economy. I think, you know, that's something that I think we should be looking a lot more at. I think that we tend to assume that the weather in Ireland is so inhospitable that we need to be kind of wrapped up in 100 layers like 9 months of the year. And that's not really the case. We can do a lot more with the outdoors, which is a much more safe environment for people to be in. We can do a lot more with sort of supporting a diverse range of activities for people to engage in at night, and maybe not exclusively, it doesn't neglect the real struggles of people in the nightclub sector.
What then, for example, and again, not to negate those struggles, but then what else could you have people doing after midnight in a city other than in some kind of a nightclub environment? Like, what does an alternative nightlife look like?
I think, I mean, you know, Culture Night is always a wonderful night in Dublin. Like, you see that it may not be past midnight, but certainly up to 11 p.m, 12 p.m. at night, people are happy to be in museums, in looking around cultural spaces, happy to be dining outdoors, maybe in market spaces. Evening markets are things that you see that are quite popular around Europe as well, with all kinds of weather conditions as well. So, I think the idea of sort of family life existing in the evening time as well in the city is something that we need to look at. And again, not into the wee small hours, but into the evening hours, certainly.
This is a question that goes beyond Dublin. So apologies to listeners who are listening from outside the capital. But do you think that the city manager, Owen Keegan, is up for that kind of environment? Because he's getting a lot of stick in today's papers for a lot of commentary that he's mentioned about other things to do with student accommodation and housing. And a lot of people see, you know, unelected executives as being a bit of a hindrance when it comes to that.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think there's a few things in there. I think, like, Owen...
Indeed there are. Yes.
Is Owen Keegan personally have the vision for doing these kind of things? I would disagree with a lot of Owen Keegan's vision for what Dublin should be at the moment. I disagree with what he sees the role of Dublin City Council as being. But probably more than that, I don't think that an unelected chief executive is the person who should be leading and guiding that vision for the city. So this comes back to me, not necessarily exactly down to the particular viewpoints of Owen Keegan, because I think whoever's in charge will always have, you may not agree with them on certain things, but how do we put that person in charge? And this is where I would love to see the work that is committed to in the Programme for Government progressed regarding giving us a directly elected mayor for Dublin. Somebody who can put a vision before the people, somebody who can say, this is what I believe, these are my views, they can be voted on. And if we disagree with them, as I do with Owen, on certain things, certainly, we have the opportunity then every few years to hold them to account for those views.
It's unfortunately, it's a little bit down the line because we're still awaiting a citizens' assembly on the future of local government in Dublin. We're still also awaiting some timelines about the election of a directly elected mayor in Limerick. And of course, the other cities, we don't exactly know what the future holds for them. Hugh, one thing I'm struck by in general across today's papers is generally how little is said about the budget, which once upon a time would be something that would dominate the political headlines for weeks, if not certainly at least days afterwards. The Business Post does, at least today, lead with details about the forthcoming carbon budget, which in some way might be even more meaningful and might have more of an impact in people's lives than the fiscal budget did only 5 days ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, I mean, it is striking that how little, particularly on the front pages, there is discussion around the budget. The Business Post has some good stuff, though. It has an interview with Michael McGrath and Pascal Donoghue, which is, talking through what they did and how they did it and why they did it. But Pat Rabbit has a very good column, I think, just pointing about how increasingly irrelevant budgets have become in recent years because, I mean, he's pointing out the fact that there was that the economic forecast, the deficit forecast for next year was much better, or this year rather, was much better than they had projected, an extra £6 billion found, £7 billion in fact. But there was hardly
they're going to be borrowing 14 or 15 billion less over the last 2 years than they originally intended to.
Despite that, there isn't a desire within government to borrow that money and to put it into the kind of investments that other parties are to dedicated towards the sort of investments in public services other parties have been calling for. And, you know, instead it's kind of an incrementalist budget which has people kind of shrugging their shoulders and saying kind of, what's in it for me? But you're right, the carbon budget is and Janet will know more about this than I would, but it's much more substantial in terms of how it's going to affect people's lives over the next 3 years. And the reading of the Business Post story seems to be that we're going to be weighting budgets with a slow ramp up over the next 2 years, and then as we get to the back end of the decade, there's much more going to be required of certain sectors. But I mean, even the targets being set over the next 2 years to reduce carbon emissions by 8-9%. I mean, we shut down the country for most of 2020, or felt like most of 2020, and I think was it 6% reduction
in
carbon
emissions.
So if
we need to make, I think, annual cuts of about 7%, and even with everything that just naturally happened as a result of lockdown, it didn't do nearly enough.
It's going to be a very hard target to meet.
Janet, so there's at least some speculation in this in the Business Post. You know, it's become a fixture now that we have so many weeks of speculation about what's going to be in the financial budget. I suppose this is the first time we've seen speculation of what's going to be in the carbon budget. There's talk of the electricity sector having to cut its emissions by up to 80%, and fair enough, because we all want to have sustainable energy that doesn't pollute the planet while we're doing it. Agriculture facing emissions cut of at least 21%. Given the amount of emissions that agriculture is responsible for, do you not think that 21% over a decade isn't very ambitious?
I would like to see there to be a higher cut, but I'd also, I think there is, this is, I'm guessing the best sort of tension between the realistic political constraints, the reality of the current setup of the economy. So to completely divest from agriculture would not only be politically incredibly unpopular.
One way or another, anyway, don't we?
Yeah, but it's not feasible with how the economy is set up. So I think that there are low hanging fruit potentially in some aspects of how we can do things. Carbon sequestration has been talked about a lot this week with the peat restoration and how that can be done. I think that's a huge element of how agriculture can take positive steps towards emissions reduction. But there's other transport sector. Arguably, there is more immediate, more low hanging fruit that is going to have very real impacts on how all of us get around.
What's low hanging in your mind? What are the obvious first steps that you could do to make meaningful impacts?
Well, for me, in Dublin, where we look at as being one of the most congested cities in Europe and one of the air pollution levels in certain parts of the city are off the charts, the obvious thing to do is to do the very quick, immediate rollout of cycling infrastructure that we've seen this across the city in the past year, and to scale that up. And people, I know it has been controversial, it has been difficult the past year, and it has caused plenty of talk, but we need to be scaling that up massively. We need to be providing an infrastructure that means that children are going to feel safe cycling to their school, parents are going to feel safe picking up their kids from school, older people are going to feel safe on bikes in the city, and that is a huge chunk out of our emissions if we can make people feel that they are safe and comfortable choosing a bike.
And that's fair enough, and I do have to go to a break and I'll go to it in just a minute, but I suppose you could make the argument that if you were to do all of that overnight, and I accept it's not overnight, it's not easy to do, you'll have people complaining in certain parts that the road traffic is unfairly impeded, and there's all of that, and you take that as a given. But if you do all of that and you could do it overnight, you might reduce emissions by a few percentage points in 1 year. But then what do you do the next year then to keep going and keep going and keep going? Because ultimately you need to start electrifying basically every bit of public transport there is in the country, which will take years and which might not actually have the huge impact that you think it does. And then, of course, there's the whole cost of and the carbon impact of going to buy new trains when you've got other ones that already work.
I think for me, the issue is there's some really good public transport projects coming down the line. You know, Bus Connects is going to transform, I think, Dublin's transport. But that's taken years. It will take years yet until we've got that fully implemented. Mm. So it's looking at what can take an immediate impact and then what's going to take a longer term impact. When it comes to looking at a 45% reduction in transport emissions over the course of the next decade, then that is radically going to impact on all of our lives. So I think the transport towards the end of the decade, we will start to see the effect of the likes of Bus Connects. We will start to see the impacts of hopefully some other major public transport infrastructure projects. But if to get things moving and to get things kicking off, the quickest thing we can do, the thing that will give us the biggest return on our investment.
The immediate bang for the buck. Yeah.
Economically, carbon-wise, cycling infrastructure.
I'm still joined in studio by Hugh O'Connell of the Sunday and Irish Independent and by Green Party councillor Janet Horner, who admitted during the break that she has only just finished reading Beautiful World, Where Are You? By Sally Rooney, which means that you're probably the best person to refer to as the only one of the three of us in the studio who has read the book and therefore might be prepared to comment on some of the backlash that she's getting in some of the papers today about her opposition to having the book translated into Hebrew, at least by one particular Israeli publishing house. All of this because she's endorsing what's called the BDS, the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions campaign against Israel. Janet, explain.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that is interesting, I think, is that one of the characters in the book is an author who is quite bemused by the amount of speculation and talk that goes around her life and her decisions that she makes. And it's sort of, so I can imagine that there's sort of autobiographical elements in that, and that Sally Rooney is probably quite bemused by the amount of column inches that have been spilled over her decision to what is it within her control and within her decision-making powers to make as an author to decide which publishing firms that she does work with. Obviously, you know, there's a lot of people have very strong feelings regarding the BDS campaign and whether it's the most, I think, we're looking at the article by Alan Shatter here. And
Author Alan Shatter. Page 29 of today's Sunday Independent.
Who is very strongly characterizes BDS as a very destructive, nihilistic, I think he references it as, campaign, and that it's not a constructive way to engage with it. I would disagree with that. I think that boycott is by nature disruptive. If it's not disruptive, it's not a boycott. You know, it's not an effective means of doing things. So I think from that point of view, this has been a very effective means for her to take. It has certainly generated a lot of interest in it. It's got people talking about BDS in a way that few other things may have done. And looking at the situation in Israel-Palestine, I think the idea that it is not constructive is also... You know, I mean, there's certainly the process of building peace in areas is always going to be incredibly complex. So not to put too simplistic an idea on it, but I also do know that acts of solidarity, such as acknowledging the conflict and engaging with and refusing to have it published, is likely to be much appreciated and understood by people who are involved in the work of peace building in that area.
I did think on the topic of peace building, I saw some references during the week to the idea that this was now going to hamper Middle East relations at such a delicate time. And in fairness, I don't think that they were exactly on the precipice of a two-state solution. So I don't think Sally Rooney is the reason why it might all fall apart. Alan Shatter is writing in his piece in the Sunday Independent that she wrongly labels Israel as an apartheid state. And she references, quote, Israel's system of racial domination and segregation against Palestinians, which he says is completely untrue, because Israel is a state where all those of all denominations, colours, ethnicities, nationalities and backgrounds work in and are patients in Israeli hospitals. They share the same buses. They work together in the same businesses. They study and teach together in the same universities. In fact, I'm pretty sure that the new Israeli government is propped up by a few MPs who represent Arab interest parties in the Israeli Knesset. So what about that argument that she is kind of unfairly targeting Israel, or that at least some of the commentary that she has made about Israel isn't fair, and that it might actually be contributing to anti-Semitism rather than trying to deal with it constructively? Janet.
Yeah. I don't know whether I can deconstruct all of that within two sentences, but do you know, I mean, obviously the BDS campaign and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict are deeply entangled issues, and the role of BDS as a particular campaign tool is, I think, what has largely been interrogated here. So is it Sally Rooney's responsibility to necessarily refine and perfect the campaign tools to be used in what is an incredibly difficult, intractable conflict?
She's an author, and you know, she's entitled to support the campaigns that she wishes to support, I would argue. And it, you know, that can be the subject of public debate and commentary. But ultimately, you know, Alan Shatter seems to be trying to tie in the fact that she supports BDS, that, you know, it should be, and he goes on to say that he refuses to believe that she supports the ideals of BDS, which he claims include opposing peace talks, opposing a two-state solution, and having the ultimate objective to end the existence of the Israeli state. I mean, that's tying in a huge debate and a huge point of conflict in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian dispute with a campaign to, you know, that she's entitled to support. I wonder why it's causing so much fuss. I mean, I think it's, you know, Sally Rooney is someone who gets an awful lot of attention. She's a very good author. She's written some really good books. And I think that should really be the focus of things. I mean, I'm also noting the fact that she's very interesting views on football about Mohamed Salah.
She says that watching Mohamed Salah play football
is not unlike staring up at the stars and contemplating the vastness of the universe. It makes my own life seem nice and small. I mean,
that was a very artful
Manchester
way of
United fans coming out quibbling with that, do you?
So, no, you don't, in fairness.
I think my view really on this is that she should just be left alone to have her views, and that it shouldn't be generated
as much newspaper comments as it is. And for no one else to talk about it. There is one, I said that there wasn't much in the papers about the impacts of the budget. There is one thread which does get some pickup in the papers, because maybe of the gendered aspect that was in it, which is the decision that the government made to roll out free contraception to women under the age of 25, which is the subject of some writing by Jean Kerrigan and by Ailish O'Hanlon in the Sunday Independent, by Ali Bracken as well. Janet, I suppose that there's the argument that yes, it's a good starting point, but that if you are going to make this your starting point, and if that segment of society is going to be the only segment that gets free contraception for a while, that it's seen as kind of putting the whole reproductive burden on women and not on the men who are equal partners in conception, are they?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think basically the debate over the past week has been really positive. Do you know, we're not having a debate about whether or not free contraception should be is a good for society overall. There are a few voices that are questioning that, but overall we're talking about how to roll out the most effective.
Why aren't we doing more of it?
And more effective free contraception, which is the right conversation for us to be having. So, I mean, women, do you know, there's a reality of it, which is that at the moment, most women are the ones paying for their contraception. They're the ones paying for their doctor's visits. They're the ones who are dealing with the health consequences of maybe being prescribed the wrong contraception at points. There is a burden on women for contraception. Part of this is seen as recognizing that and coming into it. I think the education piece comes into it next, which is there's bits around sex education and changing culture around that's relationships as well.
Is the commentary about all of this almost more gendered than the decision is? Because a lot of people don't understand that there's certain forms of contraception that just simply don't work for some women, that it might cause them other adverse health things, and that actually this is more constructive than a lot of people would realise.
I think there's a huge bit that is the education pieces to go with it. Like, none of these things are silver bullets. Like, none of them is going to say, look, we've no more problems with crisis pregnancies, sexually transmitted diseases, or coercive relationships or anything in the country because we have introduced this one measure. It is part of a suite of measures that has to include more holistic, more comprehensive sex education, relationship education for young people and older people, and a lot more understanding of the health consequences. I think one of the other measures, which I think is really positive in it, is investment in menopause support and menopause healthcare. I think that's really, really important. And that's something that you'll see we've next to never talk about on our airways, thanks to Joe Duffy for, you know, shattering that. But it's a huge issue that affects so many women's health. And I think, so overall, this is part of and one of many measures that we are take now and that we should be taking into the next number of years to look much more at how we can improve women's health and relationship health in general.
There's loads more that we could talk about because there's lots of different threads in today's papers. I'm afraid we are completely out of time. Green Party Councillor Janet Horner, thank you very much for coming in to us, and to Hugh O'Connell, political correspondent of the Sunday and Irish Independent.